Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Don Stiff is one of Galway's finest musicians and singers, and he's toured with the Kilfenora Cayley Band and the phenomenal Cherish the Ladies. But he also took a long time to find the courage to go back to the Roscrea mother and baby home where he was born and find out what happened to the mother who gave birth to him there. And I'm delighted to say that Don joins me in the line now from his home in Headford. Good morning, Don.
How are you, Miriam? How are you?
Great.
How are you keeping?
I'm great. Thanks so much for joining us. Listen, we've lots to discuss, Don, but I came across you really because you sing so beautifully that song, Shanna Golden, and I'm going to play that first. Tell us a little bit about this song and why you love singing it.
God rest my dad had a cassette tape called The Wandering Man, and that was a tape that was by Sean McCarthy, and he's the man who wrote Shanna Golden. Mm. And that was left in our car when I was very young, and that song used to be always playing in the car, so it installed in my head ever since I was quite young, and I was just fatuated with it, and I love Sean McCarthy singing as well, but the song really got to me and the words and the story of it.
It's beautiful. Let's listen to you now, Don, before we chat. It's Don singing Shanna Golden.
Oh, the cold winds from the mountains are calling soft to me. The smell of scented heather brings bitter memory. The wild and lonely eagle up in the summer sky flies high o'er Shanna Golden, where my young Willie lies. I met him in the winter time when the snow was on the ground. The Irish hills were peaceful and love was all around. Scarcely 21 years old, a young man in his prime, we were married, my darling Willie, by the eve of Christmas time. Do you remember, darling, we walked the moonlit road? I held you in my arms, I would never let you go. Our hands, they were entwined, my love, all in the pale moonlight, by the fields of Shanna Golden, on a lonely winter's night. Then came the call to Aaron's love, and the hills, they were aflame. Down from the silent mountains, the Saxon strangers came. I held you in my arms then, my young heart wild with fear, by the fields of Shanna Golden, in the springtime of the year. You fought them, darling Willie, all through the summer days. I heard the rifles firing in the mountains far away. I held you in my arms then, your blood ran free and bright, and you died in Shanna on a lonely summer's night. Oh, but that was long ago, my love, and your sun grows fine and tall. The hills, they are a piece again, the Saxon stranger's gone. We'll place a red rose on your grave by the silvery pale moonlight, and we'll think of Shan Golden on a lonely winter's night.
Beautiful version there by you, Don, of Sean McCarthy's Shan Golden. Really beautiful. You get asked to sing it a lot, don't you?
Well, I do, Miriam, and I got quite a surprising phone call last November from Phil Coulter. I didn't think it was Phil that was on the phone, and he had heard it. He was doing research for his new album, and he said he loved the version of it. And then when we made contact and had a chat, he asked me to go on his Irish tour with him there last year. So I ended up doing 8 or 9 or 10 concerts around Ireland with him from November of last year, which I was delighted, you know, that Phil had contacted me. But that's how high pristine that song sits with me anyway.
And we're going to hear one of your own tracks in a while as well, because you write your own songs. You have a fascinating backstory, Don. First of all, sympathies to you, because I know you lost your mum recently to COVID-19, didn't you?
I did, Miriam. Yeah, we lost our mum there on the 7th of April, 5 or 6 weeks ago, and very sad time for us. She was a great lady. She was 80, coming on 87 years of age, and she had a tough old life. She had bad health problems, but she had kicked everything down the road. She was a wonderful woman, and she just had got a kind of a chest infection and went into UCHG in Galway there, where the staff fantastically looked after her. But just as she was getting ready to come out home on the Sunday, we were waiting for her. She was discharged, and then her oxygen levels went down, and the poor lady, the following Tuesday, she got a heart attack and she never recovered from it. And she passed away there. I suppose we could say, I know she was on her own in Nonee, but there was probably one of the nurses, but it was so sad that we couldn't be with her when she passed away. But that's the whole thing in this pandemic, has left its mark. But we miss her dearly, I have to say.
I'm so sorry about that, Don. And of course, you were adopted by her and your wonderful dad. But you have a great story about going to find your birth mother. Tell us about pulling up in that garage in Ross Grey and what you knew about your birth mother at that stage, Don.
Oh yeah, I was coming home from a gig. I was doing a concert with the Kilfenora Cayley Band around 2016 there, and I pulled into a garage that I always stop for a cup of a coffee, and it's right across the road from where Sean Ross is in Ross Grey, and I'm always trying to give myself courage to go in to Sean Ross, but on this particular day, I was sitting there drinking my coffee, wondering whether I would go across the road to the Abbey, and I got kind of dumbfounded with myself. I was ready to go home, couldn't get the courage, and then a priest pulled up behind me in a car, and he was the man that was after hosting the concert the night before with the Kilfenora Cayley Band. And I told him my story, and he said, look, go for it, go across there today. And I did. I walked over. I drove over across the road, parked my car, and I didn't realise that that day they were having the first mother-baby commemoration in Sean Ross. And I went up and said a prayer at the old graveyard, which about 6 months before that, I was after reading the book about Philomena's son, Anthony. Philomena Lee. And as I was walking down from that grave, I met this lady and her daughter, and she just thanked me for praying up at the graveyard. And I said I was actually praying at Michael Hess's, and she said, yes, that's my son, Anthony. And from there on then, we had a great conversation. I told her I was going home, and she said, no, you have to come down to the commemoration. So I walked down with her and her daughter, and from that day on, I made lots of contacts at Sean Ross that day, which led me to finding out my birth mother, Margaret, who had actually passed away. I was about 6 months into my search when she had passed away in England. But I ended up finding a very big family of 9 brothers and sisters.
Was it devastating after 6 months to find out that your birth mother was dead, Don?
It was, really, because, you know, there was a hole in my heart. I had kind of anticipated that I would meet my mother or father one day. But It was devastating to find out that she had passed away. But, I had met, that journey brought me to meet my family, which my first point of contact was my sister Marie in Dublin. And I met Marie, and then I met my brother Tom on the same day. And I also made contact with another brother, and there's a brother in England, and there's four other sisters as well. Three other sisters actually in England that I have to meet. But we were to do that this spring, Miriam, but then the pandemic came and the travelling restrictions are in place, so I'll have to wait for another little while.
Well, that's wonderful, John, because you got this whole new huge family, so you'll never be lonely.
Well, it's fantastic and it's great and it's a new lease of life and it's a new journey. And please God, I'll get to meet them all very, very soon entirely. But I'm happy with myself that I found a new family. You couldn't ask for anything better.
And Don, congrats with all your success. Keep going. And we're going to listen now to a song you wrote, Don. And I know you say when you sing it, you always think of both your mother and your birth mother, don't you?
I do indeed, yeah. This was a song for my mother in Galway. I think of them both dearly, but this was for her to tell her that she would always be my mother no matter what happens. And this is for all adoptee people out there to say there's always somebody thinking of you.
Oh, Don, thanks so much. And we're so sorry about what happened to your mother. We listen now to some of your song, You'll Always Be My Mother.
I still remember the day I came in, and you were looking so sad. I knew you'd been talking to someone, and they had hurt you real bad. To upset you was something real hard to do, 'cause you're so strong down inside. So you told me to sit down, and we talked of what happened, and the two of us sat there and cried. You said somebody told you that I found my real man. You were glad, but you didn't mind. It just hurt you that somebody else had to tell you. You thought I'd tell you myself in good time. Now to see you.
Don Stiff there singing his own song, You'll Always Be My Mother. We go to Patrick Kavanagh now and his beautiful poem, Bluebells for Love. And joining me on the line is one of our finest Patrick Kavanagh scholars, Una Agnew. Good morning, Una. Thanks so much for joining us. I know you really want to read this poem of Kavanagh's before the end of the month. Why?
It's because it's set for Bluebells for Love in May. When Kavanagh wrote this, he said, there will be bluebells growing in the woods in May. He wrote it for the love of his life, Hilda Moriarty.
No, it's beautiful. Where did you get your interest? I've interviewed you and your brother before, Una, because I know you're both experts in Kavanagh. Why do you love his poetry so much?
Well, I think he celebrates the ordinary. I'm a country, we're country people ourselves, you know. I live only a few miles from Inneskeen, and that landscape is really imprinted on my mind and my art. All of the subjects of Kavanagh's poetry, they're very close to where I come from. Now, as well as that, Kavanagh was such a complex character in many ways and deeply spiritual. And that probably is what took hold of me very much, that he managed his life by writing poetry. And it was a difficult life. So it's a great example to all of us, really, that one can manage one's life by writing and by dealing in poetry. But anyway, this one is Bluebells for Love in May.
Off you go, Una. Read it for us now, please.
Okay. Bluebells for Love. There will be bluebells growing under the big trees, and you will be there, and I will be there in May. For some other reason, we both will have to delay the evening in Dunshaughlin to please some imagined relation, so both of us came to walk through that plantation. We will be interested in the grass, in an old bucket hoop, in the ivy that weaves green incongruity among dead leaves. we were put on surprise at carts that pass, only sometimes looking sideways at the bluebells in the plantation and never frighten them with too wild an exclamation. We will be wise. We will not let them guess that we are watching them, or they will pose a mere facade like boys caught out in virtue's naturalness. We will not impose on the bluebells in that plantation too much of our desire's adulation. We will have other loves, or so they'll think. The primroses, or the ferns, or the briars, or even the rusty paling wires, or the violets on the sunless sorrel bank. Only as an aside, the bluebells in the plantation will mean a thing to our dark contemplation. We'll know love little by little, glance by glance. Ah, the clay under these roots is so brown, we'll steal from heaven while God is in the town. I caught an angel smiling in a chance look through the tree trunks of the plantation as you and I walked slowly to the station.
Una, thanks so much for joining us this morning. You're one of Kavanagh's finest scholars. Thank you for reading Bluebells for Love. And of course, the Patrick Kavanagh Centre in Inishkeen and County Monaghan, which is looking absolutely wonderful, I gather, will be opening again this summer on July the 20th. Thanks so much for joining us, Una. 30 short years ago, of course, Ireland was experiencing a very different summer. There was no lockdown. We were shoulder to shoulder, of course, on the terraces, singing as one, sharing food, drinks and hugs as we loved every single second of Italian 90. Well, on the phone now is, of course, one of the heroes of that summer, the great Paddy Bonner. Good morning, Paddy.
Good morning, Miriam. Pleasure to talk to you.
It's your birthday this week. We share a birth year. Congratulations.
Yes, we've just passed my birthday. It was on Sunday last. So I'm, yeah, we had a great day. And on lockdown, as we are here in Glasgow, we're a couple of weeks behind you. But we had, I had a really nice day. My only downside was, small downside, I've got to say, was not being back in Donegal, and with a twin brother there, Dennis, we kind of missed out sharing it together.
You have a twin, do you? I find twins fascinating.
Yeah Dennis, we've slightly different. We're not identical for sure when you watch the two of us together, but we're very, very close. And he went on and played football too in League of Ireland, played with Galway, Finn Harps, Sligo, centre half, and I went across the water to play professional football with Celtic. So there is some sort of similarities, but we're probably different in personality too, but we're very close.
So remind people, Paddy, especially if you and your twin ended up being such good footballers, where you grew up and where the grow for football came.
Yeah, well, my dad wasn't really a footballer or anything like that, but he was really interested in sport, you know, and he was really, even when we started play, he was our biggest supporter and travelled with us all over the place. But I can't remember going out and playing football with him. I just think it was the thing to do when we were young. I don't know how we got really, really interested. Probably gone back as far as 1970 World Cup when the great Brazil team was there. Probably was our first experience of football. We played Gaelic football, of course, too. And both Dennis and I have played and represented Donegal at senior level, at minor and under 21. So it was in us, probably. I had an uncle. We had one uncle only who died very young, 21. And apparently he was a very good footballer. And maybe that's where we kind of had our genes from. But apart from that, we were probably having a twin brother out in the country too. That's all we did. There was nothing really much more. We didn't play golf or athletics. It was only maybe at school on an odd occasion. And we just played football from, you know, morning till night when we weren't doing other jobs.
And how or why do you think it was soccer the route you went as opposed to, say, Gaelic?
Well, we did play Ga, as I said. We played with the local team and then represented our county. But soccer was a big thing because of maybe the connections with Scotland. A lot of people worked in Scotland, brought it back. And soccer at that time was very, very strong in Donegal, the North West League, when we were kids were there. And then the Donegal League started up. And there was just a big connection with soccer. Even the islands like Ardmore Islands, just off where we live, they had a big connection with Scotland too, and there were some, you know, people from years before us went off and played for Hibs over in Scotland, and you know everybody was into Celtic, of course, because of the connection there. So I just think soccer, it was it was strong in Donegal, probably maybe stronger then than it is now at a certain point, but then that's me looking in certain glasses. Mm. But we just loved playing it, and there was a group of us young guys around the place. We had our local club, Cage Rovers, and that tended to drag us in there, and we played in the evenings with even the senior guys, which was a kind of common thing then. You know, there was no schoolboy football, but you went over and you got a game with the older guys, and you just got playing in that way.
Sport and soccer, Paddy, of course, they're so important to millions, maybe billions of people right around the world. People have been missing it. I mean, what do you think of the attempts now, you know, to broadcast to empty stadiums? Do you think that's working?
We have to go to get back somehow, and if that's the direction we've got to go to get back, people will adapt. I remember playing a closed door game myself when I was at Celtic. We had played the previous year against Rapid Vienna, and there was a bottle thrown onto the pitch, and we ended up having to replay the game at Old Trafford. And the following year, we had a further discipline that we had to play against Atletico Madrid in a closed door game, and it was a horrendous experience, I've got to say, from a player who was used to such a vast crowd at Celtic Park and on a weekly basis to walk out into an empty stadium. Of course, we didn't have the restrictions like that you would have now with COVID, where you would have to have a lot of discipline put in there. We walked out and it was just an empty stadium, but it was eerie, I've got to say, Miriam, and I didn't like the experience. I think players will adapt, and eventually they will get probably used to playing it. I know that some of the stations like Fox and that are putting across some sound effects with the games. I work for BBC on a weekly basis, as you probably know.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed not just going to commentate on the game, but the atmosphere inside the stadiums. And when that's missing, it's going to be a little bit difficult. And it's probably up to us then, the co-commentators and the commentators, to actually create the atmosphere somehow and that. So I don't know how it's going to go, but we do need to get back playing somehow eventually. And I think the other thing I've got to say is that people miss sport. Also, Ireland's renowned for its sport and soccer and Gaelic and rugby and all the other individual sports. And it's wonderful. And people do miss it. And it's got a place in society now. And that's the big thing.
That's so interesting you say that, because I notice even, say, in my home where I've got young sons and daughters, and at work here in RT, so many people really miss sport. It's like it's a huge loss in their life.
Yeah, I think so. And in team sports in particular, you know, that sort of kind of getting together and enjoying your sport and then talking about it afterwards and commentating on it, and just the whole thing, even going down to the pub for a pint and talking about the game that day or whatever happened at the weekend. And it's a massive industry, and people don't recognise at times that it is an industry, and it's worth a lot of money, of course, we know that. But I think just from a people's general sense of well-being, that they love talking about sport, and you know, anytime I get together with guys or indeed the women and sit down and talk about it, the knowledge that they have of sport now is quite incredible, and they have great conversations, and you know, everybody's got their own favourite team or county or whatever it is, and when you bat one against the other, it gets into that sort of realms of real energetic conversation.
Do you miss Donegal?
Yeah, I do, and that's one of the downsides. When living here in Scotland, we can't get over, and you know, this time of the year, especially with the great weather, and you know, you miss people. I tune into radio, Irish radio, a lot when I'm out gardening or walking or whatever, and almost on a daily basis, and I listen to it from the Highland Radio to you guys in RTA, and I keep in touch very much with it. But you miss going over just to meet people and go for a walk and do all of that type of stuff. And I think this time of the year, or this time now that we're going through, it's a great time to reflect. I'm 60 years old, and I kind of look back to those first 20 years of my life in Donegal, and you kind of sit down and you reflect on it, and you think back to, oh, what a fantastic place it was to grow up, you know. And it was different than probably people who brought up in the city, but certainly it has given me some things that probably, that resilience fact also, that we as young professional footballers, when we go away when we're sort of 16, 17, 18, and you can almost straight into a team at 8, 19, 20, and you've got to be resilient. And I think now when we look at the COVID thing, I think the younger generation going through this experience might help them a little bit too in the future. Who knows?
Well, look, Paddy Bonner, as ever, it's a joy to talk to you. Thanks so much, Paddy. Well, of course, the race is on to find a vaccine for COVID-19, and leading the way is the team at the Jenner Institute in Oxford University. And the pressure rests on its director, in a way, Professor Adrian Hill, a Dubliner who grew up in Ranelagh. He's leading the project, which it's hoped could be ready by September. I spoke to him the other night on Primetime, found him so interesting, so I thought I'd speak to him for a longer length of time. Good morning, Professor Adrian Hill.
Good morning to you, Miriam.
Thanks so much for joining us. First of all, go back. Tell me about, you grew up in Dublin.
I did indeed, yes. I was in Dublin for the first 20 years of my life, went to school in Belvedere and then went to college at Trinity.
Then, of course, you ended up in this Jenner Institute in Oxford University, which is an extraordinary history. Tell me about it.
So it's called after Edward Jenner, who lived way back in the 18th century. And he was probably the first guy to ever give a vaccination, and that was in England, not far from Bristol. And he used what was effectively a vaccine against smallpox. And, you know, the rest is history. It took him 200 years to, well, it took the world 200 years to eradicate smallpox after that. But it's gone, the first human infectious disease to be eradicated.
Where did you get your interest in viruses? Because I think your usual research, isn't it, is on malaria.
Yeah, that's right. Well, my main day job, if you like, is on malaria and making malaria vaccines. But as director of the Institute, you keep an eye on a lot of things going on in the place. And viruses are extremely important targets for vaccination, you know, for HIV, for all sorts of influenza and other respiratory viruses. And now, of course, at the moment, most important of all, COVID-19. So it's my colleague, Sarah Gilbert. We've worked together for many, many years, who is leading on the COVID project herself and has made great strides in getting a vaccine into the clinic just over a month ago now.
And tell me how that work happens. I mean, all the work, for instance, you've been doing in the Jenner Institute on malaria, for instance, but it's not a virus. But of the research you've done, say, on malaria down the years, is any of that of use when you're trying to come up with a vaccine for COVID-19?
Definitely. In fact, the vaccine type, or we call it a vaccine platform, that's used for the COVID vaccine was actually invented for malaria. Now, malaria is a very tough disease to vaccinate against. It's not a virus. It's a protozoan parasite. It has thousands of genes and very difficult to design a vaccine that would work. But we have done a lot on that, and we're making good progress. But the idea these days, of course, is you don't use the whole bug or the whole virus as a vaccine usually. You dissect out the relevant part of it, one gene that will encode the protein that you want to use to vaccinate with. So the idea is you use an inactivated virus. It's actually a sort of common cold virus that infects lots of people, but you cripple that so it can't replicate, can't cause any harm, and take the key gene from whatever you want to vaccinate against, whether it be a malaria parasite or, in this case, the COVID virus. You put that single gene into the carrier virus, and then you inject the carrier virus with the gene inside, and you get a strong immune response against whatever gene you put in. In this case, of course, COVID. So that's a kind of general technology that can be used for things as diverse as malaria viruses and even cancer. People are trying to vaccinate against cancer with that general approach. And it has the advantage that you can make those vaccines pretty quickly. And we've had a lot of experience here in doing that because it's a big institute with lots of different programs. And of course, being able to manufacture them is crucial as well, and manufacture them quickly.
So, put simply, are you basically altering the genetic code?
We are altering the genetic code of the carrier virus, which, as I said, is a kind of common cold virus. And we're stopping that, firstly, causing a cold by stopping it replicating. And then, yes, we're putting a gene into its genome, a very small genome, about, you know, 35 kilobases, 35,000 nucleotides. So, yes, it is genetic engineering, and that's kind of where I started off after doing medicine. I learned about molecular biology, which was very new then in the late 1980s, and that genetic experience has now been translated into making new genetic vaccines.
And how do you know, as you said earlier, Adrian, Sarah, your colleague, is kind of spearheading the pursuit for the vaccine for COVID-19. Where are we now? And your vaccine, is this right? It's been tested on rhesus mac monkeys. How did they react?
Yeah, so we started in mice and showed that we got the kind of immune response you'd expect from this vaccine technology, and then moved on to macaques, and that was done at a very specialized high containment facility in the United States. And those monkeys were vaccinated really to look at safety, because that's the most important thing when you're starting a clinical trial. They were not just vaccinated, but they were infected by a very large dose of the COVID virus. It's called SARS-2. And they were fine in terms of getting any adverse reaction to the vaccine, or even on challenge, there was no increase in disease. And that's what we were really looking for. But as a bonus, we saw that it prevented pneumonia in the vaccine did in all six macaques. So that was a very good and encouraging sign. What it didn't do was clear their noses of the virus completely, which you'd like to be able to do with a vaccine. But that, you know, either might be because the vaccine will never do that, or no vaccine will do that. Or much more likely, it's because we gave them this very high dose of the COVID virus, and that's much more than you'd catch yourself if you were to get infected by COVID. So against a much lower dose, the vaccine might work very well, but time will tell. Nonetheless, that gave us the go-ahead or the green light to move on to vaccinating people. We started last month. Over 1,000 people have been enrolled and vaccinated in the trial now. And just this week, we're beginning what's called a phase 3 trial. That's the last stage of vaccine development, and that might involve as many as 10,000, 11,000 people being vaccinated right across Britain at 18 different centres. So, you know, if that works, it would be fantastic news.
How nerve-wracking is it when, I suppose, a vaccine like this goes on trial? I think even in America, is this right, Adrian, a recent vaccine was abandoned as unsuccessful?
Well, there huge number of vaccines being developed. I think I saw 200 somewhere. Now, not all of those will have got into people yet. I think that number is 10. Mm. I don't think any of those 10 have been abandoned, but some of the earlier stage ones might well have been. But, you know, we're all hoping that several of those vaccines will get across the finish line and be registered and be available to be used. And the reason for that is an awful lot of people are going to need this vaccine. You know, not millions, but probably billions by the time COVID is dealt with. So that's a big ask for any manufacturer to make hundreds of millions, let alone a billion. So if you think about it, the more companies that have a vaccine that work, the better and the faster people will be vaccinated. But yes, we're just ahead at the moment in terms of being in a phase 3 trial. But then remember, there's all the manufacturing to come. We have started on that. But, you know, the day the trial finishes, if it works, you don't want to be starting from scratch then to work out how you manufacture this at an enormous scale. So that's very much ongoing, that work.
And those of you who are almost, it sounds awful to call it a race, but are ahead in terms of developing a vaccine, do you share your information? I'm just interested. Is it competitive, or do you actually share as you go along the kind of successes you're having as you try to develop a vaccine?
Well, it definitely feels like a race, I can tell you that. But we're actually not racing the other people developing their vaccines. We're racing against the virus. Obviously, the sooner you have a vaccine, the better you can control the pandemic. But as well as that, in some parts of the world, including in England and in Ireland now, the case numbers are falling. And if you don't have enough cases, you can't actually test the vaccine to see if it works. So that's one of the reasons for getting on with it as quickly as possible. Do we publish our data? Absolutely. It's been a remarkable experience in that people are no longer just sending their papers off to journals to be reviewed and then to be published a month or two later. They're putting them up online the day they finish, and it becomes available to everybody else even before it's sort of peer-reviewed. That's really quite new that's happening so quickly.
At what point, Adrian, might you know if the vaccine developed in your institute, the Jenner Institute, is a success or not? At what point can you declare it a success?
Well, we're shooting for the end of August, maybe early September, to have enough individuals in the trial who've either had COVID or not to know whether the vaccine is working. So that's the soonest it could possibly be. Mm. All sorts of things can go wrong in a big complex operation like vaccinating over 10,000 people. So far, it's gone really to time. It's gone extraordinarily well. So we'll keep going and see. But, you know, anything that delays you will delay that estimated finish date. And then, of course, there's a risk that the vaccine won't work at all. So we have to bear that in mind. But, you know, I think overall it's very likely one vaccine or another will work over the next year, and it'll start being manufactured at great scale.
It's such a fascinating area to work in. I mean, when or how did you first become fascinated with viruses and malaria and other diseases?
Yeah, well, I always had, so somebody said I had itchy feet. Well, I was always interested in far-flung parts of the world, and particularly in Africa. I had an uncle who lived there nearly all his life. He was a missionary originally. And I spent one summer in Zimbabwe when I was a very junior medical student, and that was fascinating, seeing the extraordinary range of tropical diseases and, you know, the huge healthcare burden they produced in what was then a very low income country. So I think I got very interested in malaria then and in other tropical diseases. So when I qualified, I moved into that area and started doing research on them.
I'd say, given what's happened in recent weeks, so many young people, maybe even coming out of school, will think this is a fascinating area to go into.
It is totally fascinating, and I would encourage them, because I think there's a great great future in vaccines. Somebody said to me a few months ago, well, there aren't many things we haven't got a good vaccine for now. But, of course, that referred to just infectious diseases. Vaccines are now being used a lot for cancer, lots of investment there. But even for chronic diseases and neurological diseases like dementia and Alzheimer's disease, there are people who believe they can vaccinate against that, which would be amazing, of course, if that could be developed. So there's a whole range of non-infectious as well as infectious diseases where vaccine development is doable. And if you think about it, unless you're in a company, you know, there aren't that many things you can develop in a university, you know, as an academic, and have your own research group and research team and start trying to make something that might be really quite important. So, yeah, it's a growing field. It's an exciting one, and I'd certainly recommend it.
Interestingly, the Jenner Institute, it's non-profit, which I think is relatively rare, isn't it?
Most of the investment in new vaccines is in companies, as you would imagine, either smaller biotechs or some of the biggest pharma companies in the world, you know, GSK and so on, do vaccines very actively. And in fact, we've partnered very recently our own COVID vaccine with AstraZeneca, which is based over in Cambridge in the UK. So, yes, there's a really different sort of emphasis in a university institute to industry. We're more focused on more basic research, discovering new types of vaccine technology, and yes, taking them into the clinic, into phase one, phase two, but very rarely phase three trials. We tend to partner with industry before we get to that stage, which requires much larger investment. So, yeah, we are probably the largest university-based vaccine institute anywhere, but there are huge groups all around the world really now focusing on vaccines, particularly in China, which is new, and I think 5 of those 10 vaccines that are in the clinic for COVID have come out of China. So there's a lot of global interest in this kind of approach.
Well, look, thanks so much for talking to me this morning. Finally, I know you've worked so hard on malaria yourself. How close are we, or are we not close at all, to finding a vaccine for malaria?
It's looking pretty good. In fact, now you know there's phase 1, 2, and 3 trials that you need before you register. I can tell you that we're soon to go into a phase 3 trial for malaria, which will be the final stage. So we might just be a couple of years away from getting that registered. And that's as close as we've been. So that's getting very exciting.
Well, look, Adrian, Professor Adrian Hill, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Your job is fascinating as well as being so important. If you get that vaccine working for COVID-19, people will be very proud of you all there.
We will do our best. Thanks very much, Karen.
Thanks so much for joining us. Take care. Good morning, Gavin James.
Hey, good morning. How are you getting on?
I'm grand. How are you?
I am grand. I just keep cooking things and watching Tiger King. I'm good, though. Every day feels like Monday and Friday at the same time at this point.
That's so true. But look, you have this new single, Boxes. It's already made more, I think, a million streams. And you're going to do a series of drive-in concerts. First of all, tell me about the drive-in concerts, Gavin. How are they going to work?
So you're going to have a car, I guess. It's going to be a new thing, you know. It's 1 foot forward to kind of help. In my eyes, it's a great thing to do, just kind of help the industry that we're in, that I'm in, the music industry kind of as a whole. It's people that haven't worked for 3 months and getting them back out, and it's just the only kind of concept that seems to work and be safe for everybody out now. And also, it's nice for people to kind of look forward to something during the summer, because obviously, during the summer, it was festivals and everything else to look forward to, like the marquees and the electric picnics and all that. And seeing as all that stuff can't really go ahead, it's nice to have a bit of live music during the summer in a safe way. And but it is also great to the people that I've worked with for 10 years and people that have been out of a job since February or since the start of March, and kind of go back to work in a small way. And I hope like loads of other people kind of follow suit and do these kind of gigs as well, because it's only a good thing, really, to be honest. So I'm really excited to do it. It's obviously going to be a lot different than one of the gigs that I usually do, but instead of getting people to sing along, I guess they're going to be beeping their horns and all that. But yeah, it's going to be great crack. I can't wait to do it.
And I think the great thing is you can have 4 people in a car, and some of the ticket money, which I think it's going to cost €60 a car, some of that's going to Down Syndrome Centre, isn't it?
Yeah, so I mean, Down Syndrome Centre has been a thing really close to me for many years. My nephew Dara has Down Syndrome, and I've been working with him over a couple of years for doing a few minor things, really, to kind of help out money-wise, because they haven't got government funding. So this will definitely help them quite a lot. I did a live stream for them there last week, and we raised a little bit of money as well, so that was handy. But so a portion of the profits will be going towards them, and then it's a great day, to be honest, for everybody's getting... Like people who haven't worked forever are getting paid, so it's great. You know, it's and hopefully the sun stays out for as well. It'd be great, Greg.
No, so when are they going to start?
So they start at the end of July. I have the dates in front of me now.
Off you go.
My brain is I'm an absolute sieve. So July 24th and July 31st and August 7th and August 10th, and we're doing Limerick, Cork, Waterford, and Kilkenny, and hopefully there'll be more added as well soon enough. So we can do a few of them, and hopefully other artists kind of follow suit and do the same thing, hopefully.
And listen, we're going to listen to your song, Boxes, now. Tell me about it. You wrote it. What's it about?
Our Boxes is about kind of going against the grain, really. I kind of wrote about my time in school, and even the start of it is like, went to the wrong school wearing the wrong shoes. I went to a school where if you wore like Nikes or brown shoes or something like that, you had to wear slippers for the rest of the day, which was handy because I had like size 11 and a half shoes, and they never had a size for me, so it was great. But yeah, it's about kind of following your dreams, really, and just following what you love to do. And if anybody tells you otherwise, just not to listen to them and just continue doing what you're doing and never focus on anybody else's thing. If just do your own thing, pretty much. So it's about just, doing your own thing, really.
Let's listen to it now. It's great.
Went to the wrong school, wearing the wrong shoes. They told me that I should sit down and just bite my tongue. Cause if you're lucky, you'll get to university, say 3 Hail Marys, and everything bad will be gone. But I'm so tired of standing still, and I'm not buying what you're trying to sell. So don't wake me up if you're only gonna tell me to give it up. Then say everything I do is never enough. Cause you're lying through your teeth. We don't fit into your boxes. We're all different underneath. Don't wake me up. When I got
got my first guitar. My father told me, son, four chords is all you need to show people just who you are. So I played to strangers down by the back streets, and every time they caught me dreaming, I'd say, don't wake me up. If you're only gonna tell me to give it up, and I'm not buying what you're trying to sell, so don't wake me up. Oh, don't wake me up. If you're only gonna tell me to give it up, then say everything I do is never enough, 'cause you're lying through your teeth. We don't fit into your boxes.
That's a great song, Gavin. Boxes. Now, listen, how are you finding the lockdown? I think the last time I spoke to you was in the Late Late Show. Has it got easier since then, or is it the same?
Well, you know, I'm kind of, I think at the start of the lockdown, I was missing little things like the pubs and stuff. But now not so much. I mean, kind of getting nearly used to having so many hours in the day now and just kind of filling it with, I'm starting to write a lot more. I think at the start of the whole thing, I was thinking, like a lot of people, I was feeling quite guilty about not doing much. I was just kind of sitting down eating pizza and just watching the Michael Jordan documentary for like 3 weeks. But right now I've been doing a lot of writing over Zoom. I've been learning how to produce kind of stuff at home, stuff that I wouldn't have really learned otherwise if this thing hasn't happened. But I mean, I can't wait to see my parents. Can't wait to see everybody that I love, all my mates and all that. So that when that day comes, it's going to be amazing. But it's kind of trying to stay positive through the whole thing is the main thing, really.
Yeah, and do you find that's easy to do or not easy to do, to wake up and stay positive?
I mean, it all depends, really. I've been chatting to a lot of my mates and a lot of people that kind of are in the same vein as me and just play music and stuff. And even like my sister and my man, Dan, everybody, I think we're all kind of going through the same things. Like a couple of days, you'll have loads of motivation to do everything. You'll be baking a pie and you'll be making bread and you'll be doing all this mad stuff. And then some days you'll feel like doing absolutely nothing. And but it's very easy to feel guilty about doing nothing. But I don't think you should. I think, to be honest, if you want to treat this some of these days as a bit of a breather, it's perfectly okay to do so because it's good for the head. But to be honest, it's getting easier, I guess. But I'm obviously dying to see the parents and all that again. But yeah, it's grand.
And as you mentioned earlier, Gavin, you are starting this drive-in tour. If anyone wants tickets, it's €60 a car. And the tickets go on sale at live@thedrivein.ie. They went on sale last Friday. And your lovely song Boxes, if people want to listen to that, how do they listen?
If you Google Gavin James and Boxes and look for the cartoon video that has my big ginger redhead in it, you should be able to find it.
Thanks so much as ever, Gavin, for joining us. We're going to go out on your wonderful song, Always. I'd like to thank, on this bank holiday Sunday, on sound, Andrew Kane, my producer, Sian O'Gorman. I hope you have a lovely Sunday and bank holiday Monday. Chat again next Sunday. Slán.
What am I supposed to do without you? Is it too late to pick the pieces up, too soon to let them go? Do you feel damaged just like I do? Your face, it makes my body ache. It won't leave me alone, and this feels like drowning, trouble, sleeping, restless, dreaming.